From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. As coronavirus cases and deaths continue to mount, especially in states that opened early like Florida, Texas, and Arizona, there's still so much uncertainty about schools opening up in the fall.
The Trump administration sent Education Secretary Betsy DeVos out for interviews yesterday to push the message that the White House wants schools to fully reopen despite concerns about safety and CDC guidance. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Mara, let's listen here to Betsy DeVos speaking on CNN yesterday.
There's going to be the exception to the rule, but the rule should be that kids go back to school this fall. And where there are little flare-ups or hotspots, that can be dealt with on a school-by-school or a case-by-case basis.
Now, the administration has talked about withholding funding from schools if they don't reopen this fall. We spoke on Friday with the former Education Secretary, Arne Duncan, who said the White House can't force schools to reopen. So how much power do they really have here?
Well, the federal government spends about 10% of money on K through 12 education. 90% is spent by the states. So they don't have a whole lot of financial leverage, although the president has threatened to withhold funding from schools that don't open full time and in person. The other leverage that the administration has is the bully pulpit. They're telling schools to reopen just like they told states and governors to open their economies. And we saw what happened. A lot of red states followed the president's advice, and now we're seeing these huge spikes in Arizona, Florida, Texas. This is not a time when the virus is diminishing and schools are reopening the way it was in Europe. This is a time when the virus is actually spiking in some of these states. But the problem is that opening schools is key to opening the economy because parents can't go back to work unless kids go to school. And opening the economy, you can't do that unless you control the pandemic. So it's a real problem. The Trump campaign thinks that it's a good issue for them. Suburban moms want schools to be open. But parents are desperate to open schools, but they're desperate to open them safely. So they're asking, what is the federal government's plan?
Is there a plan from the Democrats? What are the Democrats saying about all this?
Well, the Democrats are bashing Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration. They say that the administration should have a plan. What happens if there's a spike? Will parents stampede their kids out of school if kids get sick, if teachers get sick? It takes a lot of money to do the extra sanitation in schools. What about making more classrooms so you can have desks 3 feet apart? Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker, said the administration is ignoring science. She accused Betsy DeVos of malfeasance and dereliction of duty. And Ayanna Pressley, the House member from Massachusetts, said to Betsy DeVos, "You have no plan. I wouldn't trust you to care for a houseplant, let alone my child." Hmm. So Democrats are not happy at all.
Let's talk about Dr. Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. It sounds yet again like the White House is trying to, I don't know what, put him down at a lower level at this point. Admiral Brett Giroir, a member of the Trump Coronavirus Task Force, critiqued Fauci yesterday in an NBC Meet the Press interview.
"I respect Dr. Fauci a lot, but Dr. Fauci is not 100% right, and he also doesn't necessarily, and he admits that, have the whole national interest in mind. He looks at it from a very narrow public health point of view."
What's going on here, Mara, with
yeah,
the administration critiquing
him? Very narrow public health point of view, right. Look, there was a time when Dr. Fauci was in the White House considered to be the good housekeeping seal of approval. He had tremendous credibility. And he appeared with the president in the briefing room a lot. He hasn't briefed the president now since the beginning of June. He's much less useful to the White House now that they are intent on opening the economy, reopening schools. And Dr. Fauci, who generally calls it the way he sees it, says, no, we're not getting the virus under control. In many states, it's out of control. So that's not a message that the administration wants out there. So they've been not only putting distance between themselves and Fauci and criticizing him, as you just heard in that bite, but also curtailing his media appearances. He's just not as visible as he used to be.
Finally, let me just ask you briefly about President Trump commuting the sentence of his friend Roger Stone, who was convicted for lying to Congress about Russian campaign interference. Any consequences of this?
We don't know yet. There could be consequences. Only two Republicans have criticized the move. That's Mitt Romney and Pat Toomey. But the risk could be that it adds to the Democrats' argument that the president is corrupt and that he's using his office in this case to commute a sentence of a convicted felon who happens to be his friend and someone who prosecutors believed could have provided incriminating information about the president himself.
And, of course, he did not do that. NPR right. National political correspondent Mara Liasson in Washington, thank you.
Thank you.
Washington's NFL team is retiring the name Redskins after years of defending what is seen as a racist slur against Native Americans. This decision comes amid the nation's reexamination of racist terms, Confederate monuments, and statues of problematic figures coming down across America. David Glass is a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. He's also president of the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media. And David, welcome. And first, your reaction to this decision.
Well, you know, it's pretty surreal. Last on the 3rd of July, when notice came down that the Washington team was, and Dan Snyder was contemplating the change, you know, it's it was pretty emotional for a lot of us. After 3 decades of being at the forefront of this particular issue with regarding appropriating names and imagery from our communities, American Indian community, for sports teams' names and logos, it came about pretty quick, and I was reminded of you know, so many different events that we held, and the people who you know, started this organization, the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media, Charlene Teeters and Vernon Belcourt and others, and Floyd Westerman. You know, we stand on their shoulders, continuing to push the issue. So we're excited and ecstatic that they finally have, for whatever reason, have come to realize that the name and imagery has to go.
The team's owner, Daniel Snyder, defended this name, and he actually said he'd never change it. Why do you think this is happening now?
I think they, you know, the Washington team, Dan Snyder, only reacted to when the FedEx people decided to give him an ultimatum, and his minority shareholders did the same thing. PepsiCo and Nike. Nike took all the Washington stuff off their shelves. They stopped selling it. That was a huge hit for Mr. Snyder, and it was only then that he opened his eyes and decided, you know what, based on what was happening in the country, the untimely and unfortunate killing of George Floyd and so many other African Americans and American Indians who have died in a violent, brutal way by law enforcement over the years. It's a culmination of events that came together at this moment in time to have these kinds of changes happening. And at the end of the day, like I said, this country is going to be better for it, you know? I really believe it. We'll have taken a bite out of racism and bigotry. I've said this before. Racism and bigotry won't go away. However, we'll become a much better country because we've made these changes, not only with our name, but with the discussion that's going on with regards to the Confederate statues, et cetera, in the acknowledgement of some of the dark history in the building, in the making of this great country.
I really wanted to ask you, looking at the big picture, how much difference does a team name change make, especially when Native Americans face so many other challenges right now?
Well, it's a good question. There are so many issues. There are a handful of communities that are benefiting from the economic engine of gaming. However, the majority of Indian country still remains in poverty level. You know, my tribe, the White Earth Nation, is 23,000 people strong. They have a little small casino up in northwestern Minnesota with, you know, I mean, their little towns up there. So the money, and they become jobs programs, right? So there is a ton of work to do. It's not only work to do for our American Indian communities, but so many communities of poverty, the disenfranchised and underserved communities. You know, this country can do better, and we should be doing better. And I believe after this next election, we will be doing better.
David Glass is president of the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media. David, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Tanya, thank you for having me today. And let me say to your listeners, Miigwech and Gigabwabbleman, Minnewa.
And David's last words there were, thank you, we'll talk again.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
And it's no secret, parents are stressed out. The fortunate ones are working remotely from home, trying to balance the needs of their jobs, children now home 24/7, and the prospect that there will be limited or no school again in the fall. But as a new book points out, even before COVID-19, working parents were severely stressed, juggling demands of careers, their families, their health, with varying degrees of success. It's a book called Dreams of the Overworked, Living, Working, and Parenting in the Digital Age. And the co-authors join us now. Welcome Kristen Beckman. She is a professor of USC's Sol Price School of Public Policy. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Melissa Masmanian is associate professor in informatics at UC Irvine's School of Information and Computer Science. Good to have you on as well.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks, Tanya.
So you both studied 9 families working at a hospitality company, and everyone you studied was struggling with what you call the 3 ideals: ideal worker, ideal parent, and ideal body. Christine, can you explain more about those ideals?
Absolutely. These are the aspirations for what we want to be. We want to be workers that are accessible, achieving in our jobs. We want to be parents that provide enriching activities for our kids and spend quality time with them. And we want to be healthy. We want our bodies to be fit. Do we want to put healthy food in them? But doing any one of these things to our aspirations is nearly impossible. Work debt demands are always escalating. Parenting demands are a bit unreasonable, we might say. And so these working parents were always trying to juggle and trying to achieve on these 3 dimensions.
You all also focus on how technology complicates the situation by making us more available, and there are heightened expectations from bosses. I think all of us understand this idea, but Melissa, can you explain?
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is something I've studied for a long time, and I've always been fascinated by the fact that technology does allow us to do things differently. There are real kind of changes in our capabilities with constant connectivity, being able to have a smartphone in your pocket, being able to communicate through text, through email, all of these different channels. But how we use these capabilities really is up to us as a people, as cultures, et cetera, as workplaces, as families. And so one of the things I think we see broadly across these families, and probably applies to families throughout the country and the world, are that we're using these technologies to try and do better at what we value. So we're trying to enact those myths that Christine was talking about, to be better workers, to be better parents. But in so doing, we find ourselves in this trap where we're connected all the time because we all expect that each other is at each other's beck and call in service of being a good parent or a good friend or a good colleague. And so the expectations of availability and responsiveness really ratchet up.
You all conducted this study before the pandemic, before this other element came into play for parents, and that's parents being a teacher. Can you say more about that, Christine?
Yes, I think that you're right. It was hard before. It was hard before to be a parent and to juggle a job. And now you're a teacher as well as a worker, and you're having to monitor, like, are they getting their homework done? Are they on the right Zoom call? Sort of the coordinating, not just of your own life, but of their lives. And, you know, they don't just sort of go to school. I think that level of monitoring and tracking is, you know, it's unsustainable for one, right? That's just, we can't sort of do that and sort of show up to work, you know, especially as we think about moving towards the fall and not really knowing to what level schools are going to be back. And, you know, I'm hearing lots of stories about different schools are doing different things. So you might have two kids who have different school schedules. This is going to continue to be a challenge. And I think we need to sort of recognize how impossible it is and give ourselves a break about what is it that we can really stay on top of, and what are we just going to sort of let go? I mean, I think the perfect parent myth was always one that had too many things that any one person can do, you know, three enrichment activities and family dinner and, you know, tracking their technology, making sure they weren't on their devices too long. And like, it was already too much. And now it's over the top. So we have to dial back, I think, on what we're expecting of ourselves.
Christine, basically you're speaking my life. You're singing my song with your words right now. I'm listening to everything you're saying. Like,
I'm so glad to hear
so
that.
Really? Okay, I need to just let things go. Well, I already know. Like, I mean, the house is a mess. Let's just be real. So one thing had to go is that.
Yeah.
You talk in the book about how families need scaffolds. So that's basically other people to help them manage their lives, whether it be grandparents to watch the kids, neighbors, daycare, house cleaning services. But that scaffolding is almost non-existent in this age of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Melissa, how should families be thinking about building support systems in this new reality?
One of the unexpected silver linings of this incredibly tragic time that we're living through is an appreciation of that scaffolding. And, you know, there's so much work that has to go into the home front, and much of that work is invisible. Some of it is visible but not valued, like who's cleaning and doing dishes and so forth. Some of it is truly invisible. So, you know, who's remembering to put things on a grocery list or coordinating with the housekeeper. So there's all of these different kinds of invisible work that we lay out in the book. And what we found was that all of these families were in different ways and different strategies finding help for this invisible work. And they have these different structures of scaffolding, and those scaffolds are the people that are kind of being called upon to do various forms of invisible work. It's so crucial. It's always been there. And now it's becoming a little bit more visible. And as we have more and more dual working couples, which is now the majority of American families, it's not the default that there's one person at home and doing all that invisible work and in charge of the home front and the other person going to work and not worrying about it. So the need for scaffolding has become stronger. And even now, I think hopefully we're beginning to realize how important it is. In terms of moving forward, I think that what we're seeing is really conscious appreciation of scaffolds and trying to find them where we can. So we have millennials moving home with their parents. We hear a story of this, which is going to be a whole different kind of challenge. We see neighbors actually meeting each other and choosing to maybe have a like pod, a germ pod together for both practical and social support. Now, not everybody is in a privileged position to be able to do this, but just the very fact that we're appreciating the need and recognizing the work that goes into finding, cultivating, and maintaining scaffolding, I think is really important for the social fabric going forward.
Which really brings us to our next question. I mean, you all wrote this book to illuminate what is a reality for so many families in this country and really the world. What are the changes that you want to see so we aren't killing ourselves to attain all of the ideals that you write about? Christine.
There's only so much we can do in our own homes, right? We can try and think beyond the nuclear family and find structures of support elsewhere. So we can do that. But there's only so much that we can do at home, right? We need organizations to sort of acknowledge the complexity of our lives and find better ways to support it. One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is if companies are going to save 30-40% of their their income on office space, because we don't have that anymore, maybe companies need to do more to support us at home, right? There are companies mm-hmm. that are paying for in-home, you know, childcare at this moment in time, since a lot of the daycares are closed. Why couldn't companies pay for someone to help deliver your groceries or clean your house? I mean, that would have a benefit of making that work more valued, right? It would make the wages better. It would provide more job security. So if we could actually find ways to take that work that we need at home and have organizations or the government help pay for it, I think it would raise the boat for everybody. And I think that would be really useful. So along with paid leave, which I think everyone can now see how important some of the policies are that we lack in the U.S., you know, paid leave, universal pre-K, funds that help us support and help pay for the scaffolding that we need. We need help, right? Whether that's our organizations or whether that's the government. I think that's what we hope this moment will help us sort of recognize and do differently going forward.
And of course, it's okay to ratchet down on the myths a little bit. So it's okay to take a deep breath and say, this is impossible. It's okay to remind your colleagues that you have young children at home. If you're in a power position enough to do that, remind them for your other colleagues who don't feel like they can. I mean, a recent survey shows that 70% of people say they're more productive during COVID. Well, that's 30% is probably a very clear population of people with kids. That's my guess. Mm. But these are real differences in who's able to thrive in the workplace right now. And I think it's on all of us to try and make that visible and make sure that we are able to accommodate the complexity of people's lives in the workplace.
We have to schedule meetings better. We have to use technology carefully. There's lots of things that we could do very concretely as managers and as workers to sort of accommodate each other better, right? Rather than just assuming we're always going to be there and be available.
Okay, I'm taking my deep breath right now. Thank you. That's Christine Beckman and Melissa Masmanian. Their new book is Dreams of the Overworked, Living, Working, and Parenting in the Digital Age. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco may soon decide the fate of more than 400,000 immigrants in the U.S. that have temporary protected status, or TPS, on humanitarian grounds. The lead plaintiff in that case is a California teacher fighting for her mom to stay in the U.S. Farida Javala Romero from member station KQED reports.
Krista Ramos is 16, and like many of us, she's making the best of life during the pandemic. Sitting in her living room with her pet parakeet in the background, Ramos says she's looking into colleges to apply to next year and learning from her dad how to drive the family van.
We've been practicing how to drive normal, like straight, because I'm left-handed and I think it's easier to drive on the left side of the road.
The high school junior in San Pablo, California, is also deeply involved in the legal fight to stop the Trump administration from ending temporary protected status for most immigrants who have it. Without TPS, Krista's mom would be at risk of deportation, along with the parents of roughly 300,000 other kids who, like Ramos, are U.S. citizens.
I've met a lot of children who are also in the situation of losing their parents, so that's given me more courage to be able to speak out.
Over the last three decades, the federal government granted TPS to immigrants who couldn't return safely to countries torn by war or natural disaster. But the Trump administration terminated the protections for six countries, including El Salvador, where Krista's mom came from as a girl. Trump officials say TPS is no longer needed because the conditions that led to the designations have been resolved. A federal judge in San Francisco blocked the administration from ending the program, and now Ramos is waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to rule on whether TPS can continue while the case is decided.
We're getting more anxious because it's been months since the last court hearing.
But Krista Ramos and her family are finding hope in another court ruling that favored immigrants brought illegally to the U.S. as children. The recent decision by the Supreme Court found that the Trump administration didn't follow the law when it tried to end Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. Kevin Johnson is dean of the UC Davis School of Law.
I think the DACA decision will have a big impact on the way that the Ninth Circuit looks at this case.
TPS plaintiffs also argue the administration was motivated by racism. And Johnson believes President Trump himself gave strong evidence of that when he used an expletive to talk about TPS holders.
That Salvadorans and Haitians come from asshole countries and they shouldn't be granted relief. That sounds like racial animus.
For Krista, keeping her mom in the country became urgent last summer. That's when her 13-year-old brother, Diego, was diagnosed with a rare cancer.
If my mom had to go back to El Salvador, she wouldn't be able to be here for her son.
Her brother's illness has motivated Krista to work even harder to find a lasting way for her family to stay together.
Hola, buenas tardes. Aquí otra
so she speaks about the need for Congress to grant TPS holders a path to citizenship on Facebook videos and radio shows in Spanish, like this one on KIQI 1010 AM in San Francisco.
Hola, soy Krista Ramos. Soy una hija de una tepeciana.
Krista shares lessons her mom has taught her. Stay positive and keep fighting. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Yavala Romero.
Restaurants have been slowly reopening in most of the country after months of being closed to dine-in service. In Ohio, restaurants have been able to serve customers outside and inside their dining rooms since mid-May, with some significant changes to the way they operated before the pandemic. I first spoke with Jessica Parkinson, who's the co-owner of the restaurant Salt in Lakewood, Ohio, back in March, a week after she had to suddenly close the restaurant and lay off almost all the staff.
We are not selling gift cards even right now because we can't guarantee that we will reopen and we can't have thousands of dollars on our conscience at night.
Well, fast forward to late April, and like many restaurants, Salt had transitioned to offering curbside pickup of takeout.
We're fighting as hard as we can to reopen. That is our end goal. I mean, we're doing everything we can to try and maintain it and stay open and reopen.
So how are things going now? Well, Jessica Parkinson joins us once again. Jessica, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, we spoke with you in April when you had just started to do curbside pickup for takeout. How are things going now? What's the state of the restaurant?
So on June 1st, we opened our doors for patio dining and dining in the dining room, obviously, and then at the bar as well. We lost 33 seats inside of our dining room and our bar. We lost 12 seats on our patio, and then the great city of Lakewood came out and said any of those restaurants that would like to extend their patio may do so. So we were able to gain back all 12 seats on an extension to our patio, which has been wonderful.
And are most people requesting that they sit on the patio?
You know, on days where, like this past week, we've had, you know, upper 90 degree weather, they're more inclined to stay indoors. We see more of a later trend, I guess, with customers wanting to sit outside. So they wait until later in the evening when it gets a little cooler.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of other changes have you had to make in order to operate safely there?
Obviously, the social distancing with all of our tables. We're allowed to have parties of 10. We only have parties of 6. Our staff wears masks from the time they walk in the door until the time we close the restaurant down at the end of the night, including staff members in the kitchen. We have hand sanitation stations throughout the restaurant. There's one at the front door, one at the back door, one out on the patio. We have one person only in the bathrooms at a time. There are 6 feet distance markers on the floor for that bathroom. We allow up to 2 people to wait for a bathroom. The governor has mandated mask wearing, and so now they have to have a mask on within our county, I should say. So they have to have a mask on upon entrance, which we've strongly requested all along. Now it's mandated. If they don't have a mask, we'll provide you with one. You have to be masked if you're using the restroom or walking in and out of the restaurant.
Now, I have to say I'm surprised that your bar is open because in some places that's not allowed yet. How is that working out? Do people have to stay in one place at the bar or what?
Nobody's allowed to wait for anything or stand and just kind of linger around as before. So prior to COVID happening, our bar was 11 seats, first come, first serve. You know, there would be Fridays and Saturday nights where we would be three deep at the bar, very busy, people waiting for tables or whatever. Now our bar is six seats and it's only by reservation. So you can't just walk in and sit down at the bar.
Have you been able to hire back the cooks and staff that you had to lay off back in March?
Yeah, so our kitchen is, we have a really small staff. There's only like 18 of us, and that's counting myself and my business partner. In the kitchen, we have, aside from my business partner, Jill, she is back in the kitchen, and then we have two chefs back there with her, and they've never left. So they've been with us the whole time. Our PPP loan hit on April 22nd. The rest of my staff came back April 29th. So they've been around while we did curbside and carry out, and then we did all kinds of stuff to the restaurant, cleaning, deep, deep cleaning, throwing stuff out, painting, that kind of thing. Hostesses came back June 1st when we reopened our doors. So we pretty much have everybody back.
And are you making as much money as you did pre-pandemic or as you would have if there were no pandemic?
Not even close.
Hmm. Down by how much would you say?
About 75%.
Wow. But you're still able to employ all of your workers.
Yeah, we, we're obviously not making any money right now. We are just kind of paying bills and our staff and keeping our fingers crossed and holding our breath and, you know, hoping to stay afloat.
And does it feel like every week that goes by, things get better in terms of business or what would you say?
So at first, the first week we reopened our dining room, I would say that was a really scary week, right? Because you're bringing all this food product in and your inventory in for your bar. And we had really anticipated this, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like this welcome back party, so to speak, where people would come through the doors and be happy that you're open again. And nobody really came. That first week was really quiet. So Jill and I kept going, okay, did we do the right thing? Do we need to close back down? How are we going to manage this? And slowly we've seen business increasing, slowly. For us at Salt, our busy time is January to June. So all through those, 5 to 6.5 months, you're building up this nest egg to get you through these quieter months that start to happen. Well, when COVID hit back, at the end of January and was revving up in February, we saw a dip in business significantly. And then when March hit, even more so, and then the shutdown. So that nest egg that you kind of hang out in over these quieter months isn't there. So right now it's just, okay, you do the very bare minimum. And our customers have been wonderful. I mean, we still have people ordering takeout, but it is just, you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing. You're social distancing, you're ordering the PPE, you are, keeping your staff safe, which is a huge concern for us. You're trying to keep the guests safe that walk through your doors. And I feel like we just hold our breath every day because you just don't know how this business is going to go.
Has your staff been able to stay safe? Has anyone gotten COVID-19?
Nobody on our staff, thank God, has had COVID-19. There's been, hey, my roommate's cousin was at a party and somebody tested positive. There's been, one incident like that we've dealt with. But no, knock on wood, nobody's gotten sick.
Have you had to deal with any customers who have refused to wear masks, and what have you done about it?
Not yet. We're so grateful in the fact that the clientele that come into Salt, they're not you know, 9.5 times out of 10 causing issues like that. Everybody's been very respectful.
Let me ask you one more thing. The number of COVID-19 infections are going up again in many places. Are you prepared to shut down again if Governor DeWine in Ohio calls for you to do so?
So we keep hearing rumors that he will start shutting us down again. He's doing it by county, though, so it's not going to be a statewide thing. How the heck that's going to look, I have no idea. And Cuyahoga County, where SALT is located, is in like that red zone. So if we hit the purple zone, then he's shutting us down. No, it's everything is day to day, right? Should we start anticipating another shutdown? Probably. I think, honestly, right now for us, it's just a little too scary to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope things continue to go well for you. And it seems like every time we've talked to you, things have been better than they were the last time. So that's good. So, Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me again. I really appreciate it.
That is Jessica Parkinson, the co-owner of the restaurant SALT in Lakewood, Ohio.
The nation's three most populous states, California, Florida, and Texas, are all seeing spikes in the coronavirus deaths following a surge in new cases that began in June. Florida recorded more than 15,000 new cases of COVID-19 over the weekend, eclipsing the previous one-day record of just over 12,000 set by New York back in April. Let's bring in Dr. Krutika Kupali. She's an infectious disease physician and vice chair of the Global Health Committee for the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, so doctor, if Florida were a country, it would rank fourth in the world for the most new cases in a day, behind the United States, Brazil, and India. That's according to a Reuters analysis. How concerning is that to you as an infectious disease expert? And what does Florida need to do to get things under control?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about what's going on in Florida. We're seeing the cases continuing to go up. Really, what needs to be done in Florida is to really emphasize people staying away from each other, staying home, wearing masks. And I really do think Florida needs to strongly consider shutting down their restaurants, their things that don't need to be open right now. I understand that everybody's very worried about the economy. We all are. But the sooner that we get this outbreak under control, the better it's going to be for everybody.
As I mentioned, Texas is also seeing a surge in cases. Here's Governor Greg Abbott speaking to KLBK in Lubbock.
If we do not slow the spread of COVID-19, with that rise of hospitalizations that you're seeing in Lubbock, with the increased death rate we're seeing in the state of Texas, the next step would have to be a lockdown.
And doctor, this is speaking a little bit to what you're saying, but the mayor of Houston and the Harris County judge are also calling for a 2-week shutdown. Do you think it's likely we'll see a second round of shutdowns and stay-at-home orders, not just in Texas, but other states where cases are now rising again?
Yes, I do think it's very much possible. Again, you know, if people aren't taking up the interventions that we've talked about, I think it is very much possible that we are going to see a second round of stay-at-home orders. And obviously, those aren't things that we want to do, and those aren't things that we take on lightly, because they have a lot of implications that are not good, not just for the economy, but for the emotional well-being of people. However, we have to think about the overall repercussions for society, in the sense that the more that cases go up, then the hospitals become full. And as the hospitals become full, that becomes very problematic, because then we have nowhere to treat patients.
The state of California is one of the states, as I mentioned, seeing a spike in its death rate. But it was also among the first places to institute a stay-at-home order. Why is the situation so bad in California?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think those of us in California are a little bit perplexed about that as well. And I think that it's important to keep in mind that there's a couple of different things going on in California. So in California, one of the things that has led to the increased number of cases is that we've had a couple of outbreaks in our prison system. Another thing that we also need to keep in mind is that COVID-19 tends to infect racial and ethnic minorities disproportionately. If you look at the numbers in California, over 55% of those who are infected are Latinx individuals. Mm-hmm. And those are the people who are less likely to be able to do the things like shelter in place and be able to have the luxury of being home from work. And so they're going to be more likely to be exposed.
It's really hard to believe, but it's been almost 6 months since the first confirmed case of COVID-19 was reported here in the United States. Have we gotten any better at testing and contact tracing, or are we still lagging behind?
Overall, yes, we have gotten better at testing, right? But we are by no means where we need to be when it comes to testing, right? In many ways, it does still feel like we're back where we were in January, February, March with testing. We are seeing what happens when there's a stress on the system all over again. People having to wait 5-10 days for test results to come back, significant delays with testing, shortages of things, again, still with swabs and reagents with testing. So those are all problems. We're starting to see problems with shortages in PPE again for healthcare workers. And so, at where we are right now with the number of cases, contact tracing isn't even something that is feasible. There's some studies that show for every person, you're going to have to trace 10 to 25 contracts. And so when mm-hmm. you have over 16,000 new cases a day, that's not something that's feasible. So what you mm-hmm. need to do is get the number of cases down to a manageable level, so then the contact tracers can do their job. That's how you maintain and manage an outbreak in this type of setting.
That's Dr. Krutika Kopali. She is an infectious disease physician and vice chair of the Global Health Committee for the Infectious Disease Society of America. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.